Hello and welcome to Ops and Hops, the podcast for those who like beer but have to work in tech to afford it. On this very special episode, I've got Trey Shirals and Josh Stout, two people I pretty much grew up with. I've got to say, the whole reason you are listening to my annoying voice right now is because of the existence of these two. They got me into tech, and really, we've riffed off each other for just decades. As we all grew into tech, we all took our own little directions. Trey and Josh have probably worked a little closer together over the years, but I just seem to intermingle here and there at different companies that they've worked at. And anyway, today I'm going to start. Usually I let the guest go, but since there are two and I'm impatient, I'm going to hop in and say I am drinking the really, really dank meme by Triptych, I believe, brewing. Honestly, it's gotten to the point I'm doing so many episodes that hard to find beers anymore, and I'm literally picking them by name. This one is incredibly hazy. It's basically a mimosa at this point. It tastes pretty fantastic, but I will say it's a little intense. Anyway, guys, take it away. Let us know what you're drinking and what you're up to these days.
Sure. I guess I'll go. I live next to Whole Foods, and that's all. So I'm hitting you with a staple of the Lagunitas.
Ooh.
Highly balanced, super drinkable. It's hoppy as hell, but
it'll get you drunk.
It does the trick.
Well, I guess I'll go next. I don't drink at home. I save that for the outside world. So I have what was left after a get-together not so long ago in my house. So we have a very drinkable, slightly disgusting White Claw.
I'm never doing a panel again. There's always one. No, that's great. So despite what people might think by your drinking choice, Trey and Josh are actually both enterprise engineers and have been for a long time. These guys have put out fires that, honestly, I've heard little stories about, and they just sound terrifying. I've definitely put out my share of fires, but these guys have really been in the weeds multiple times. So what are you guys up to now? Josh, I know you've got something you've been working on lately, consultancy type thing.
Yeah, I'll try my best. You want like a general summary of my trajectory?
Drop it.
So yeah, I mean, naturally, I started in these small business IT endeavors back in where we're all from in Georgia, and just doing basic server administration / installation of wires under people's houses, whatever you can think of, right? And I cut my teeth in a lot of that. And then I decided to head to California, as one does, and enter the enterprise world focused on infrastructure things. I worked in the government for a little bit doing infrastructure things, and then some private sector here in the Bay Area. And I guess it's like, 25 years now or something of this. It's crazy to say, but I'm hitting that number at this point. Now I run a consultancy that kind of is the SEAL team for IT, I guess. We just go in and do whatever they want really fast to get them back on track or to execute a project that they've just been unsuccessful with executing previously. So we're here to just drive it in, knock it out, on to the next.
Yeah, it sounds good. I mean, that's something you don't see a lot of. It seems like everybody tries to force as much time out of a thing as possible. Mm-hmm. That's something I've definitely encountered. It's just like, yeah, I need this thing done. And there are times that I would rather pay more to get something done faster than you to sit here and drive me insane with 9,000 phone calls just to extend this thing out multiple months. So I think that intuition is huge. And starting where you started with, God, dealing with the government, of course, you've definitely put up with enough crap to
go from real slow to a little less slow as you get out of the government. But yeah, for sure. And we'll let Trey introduce himself too. But certainly what you just said is true. The fact that we all like get stuck in this rut of going slow is, I don't know, like I really cannot stress how much I think no one in this industry should ever work for government of the United States. It's just not the right. It's just not the, as cool as it looks in your resume, it's just not the right direction. Yeah. So if you take nothing else from this, just
I'm going to take this clip and show it to one of my next guests who does. That should be really fun.
Sidebar to that real quick, just because this is super relevant. Also, just don't work for huge established companies that have been around for 1,000 years either.
Same thing.
One of our customers, I'm helping just build this API endpoint dealio to just process things for one of our customers because they refused to do any of the development themselves. So I'm grabbing some files from TP to process. And I asked him if that user could be given permissions to create directories in its own home directory.
Right.
And they told me it was a 2-week turnaround to give that user permission to make a directory. 2 weeks.
Yikes. Hopefully you're charging per hour.
I just did it on our side and
right.
Sent them out an email saying the reasons why I just wanted to do the things I did. But anyway, 2 weeks to change user permissions.
Yep. So how would you say your journey differed from Josh and where you ended up now?
Super similar. Mom and pop kind of little stuff. I was always into computers when I was younger. We didn't have money growing up to like actually have a computer. So my dad got like 3 busted 386s from work that they were ditching. And between the three of them, setting heads and cylinders and sectors in the BIOS to figure out how to install DOS is like just how I ended up getting into it. So I was always fascinated by the problem solving aspect of it. And so I think that's a big, big driving factor for a lot of people that get into this is they just like figuring it out. Understanding how it works, why it works, that kind of thing. I think that's hugely foundational to it. But similar to Josh, I did that, but Josh, he was the pathfinder. He's the one who Lewis and Clarked out to California and
crossed them Rockies.
Yeah, man. Forded a few rivers, walked a couple oxen on the way. But yeah, he got out there and I went out there to visit. And he was like, hey, man, you should apply to this company that I'm working at. They need like entry level IT guys, and I did, and many, many years later, I'm still with that company after I did a couple little offshoots, but yeah, definitely like help desk, helping little old ladies get online in the late 90s.
Right, a little Active Directory action.
Oh yeah, from Windows 2003, IIS and all that stuff to Linux and containerization and all that other fun stuff. But mostly now my big thing is I'm a big Splunk guy. I love Splunk. I love being able to just pull in disparate sources of information and using that to make decisions, build tooling, whatever.
You love being able to afford Splunk.
Yeah, really.
What's the joke? Cisco couldn't afford to pay the bills, so they bought the company.
Yeah, bought the company, right? Yeah. It's like Cisco bought Splunk for $28 billion. Or whatever the number was. Was that their licensing fee, or is that what the company
Right. Yeah, no, that's
it's like the ultimate IT brag. It's like, yeah, I got an unlimited ingest license.
Yeah. how many gigabytes are you ingesting? Oh, gigabytes?
Yeah. Right. No, I just talked to somebody at Datadog. It's always interesting when just hearing the difference, like how, and obviously I'm not on the call with him anymore, so I can say Datadog is starting to become the Splunk, the new Splunk. It's just getting so successful that it's inexpensive and it's a great, fantastic, unbelievable product, but it's just like eventually you got all these scrappy little startups coming through and a lot of them are going to disappear or get bought in no time, or Datadog's just going to buy them. Well, but with AI and everything, it's gotten so crazy.
Yeah, I can tell you that Datadog's, I mean, they are at the top of their game for their demographic and still, but their pricing is, they very much fought, they like, oh, Splunk made a lot of money charging insane amounts. We'll do that too.
Right.
I don't know if you guys know anybody at Terraform directly, but they use Datadog like deeply and they
What'd you say, Hashi?
Hashi.
Yep. Yeah, I do know several people there.
Their Datadog implementation is fairly ingrained in that company, and it is it has been a thorn in the side from a cost OPEX perspective for quite some time. And it's
is that why they went BSL?
They're trying very hard to mitigate BSL
because of the Datadog bill. That you heard it here, everybody. That's exactly what it was. Yeah,
I have limited insider knowledge, but nonetheless, it is
bullshit.
Very,
yeah, the, I didn't say that.
But yeah, I mean, like those products are all the new relics of the world. It's the new relic, right?
Right. And that's the thing. Yeah, you either die or you live to see yourself become the villain or whatever it is, or you live to see yourself become the new relic.
I genuinely think in that space, like unless you're leveraging it for like the application, like embedded libraries in applications, like parsing like useful things directly inside like the function calls and stuff, like unless you're doing all of that at that level, I just genuinely can't understand why you need to pay to send some logs into a database and parse them.
So now that we've got all this LLM stuff going on, thank you, Google. So have either of you played with some of the log parsing stuff out there, the new AI log parsing stuff? I mean, I've seen some of it at a high level so far. It's been pretty impressive, but I haven't actually really dove deep, and I don't know. I don't know if Splunk's releasing a bunch of stuff lately or what's going on.
Yeah, Splunk's been big into machine learning for a hot minute.
Right.
What years? Like, I mean, I remember seeing that as like an add-on probably like 7 or 8 years ago. And obviously they're evolving with that all the time. ITSI is big.
IT Service Intelligence.
Yeah, there you go. The product that they have is all geared around that. Personally, I don't use it enough to have a strong opinion on it other than I don't use it. We have parts of the organization that are heavily invested in it, have been for years, and they've built some cool stuff around it, and that's pretty good at determining things, but it's not this more recent. I don't think it's as bleeding edge as what's come out in the past year or two.
Sure. I imagine we'll see it pretty soon, but
I think so. I mean, if you just look at like where LLMs are now, I do think that the log parsing ecosystem is going to be shaken up real soon.
Yeah.
Especially as you increase the amount of data you can feed into the input, right, at any given time. And even with like GPT-4, we have a fairly good ability to feed a lot of data in now, and it's getting better. And so I can't imagine that general, like if you imagine like how you traditionally did like a log parsing like engine where you went in and defined fields and like wrote regex and blah, 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 blah. I cannot imagine that that is going to be a thing that you need to do within 3 to 5 years.
I haven't written a lick of regex for the past 6 months, at least 6 months now. I've done a lot of things that needed regex, and I just put the text in OpenAI, drop the text in, and I just say, hey, remove all of X or find this whatever. Write me a regex,
and they provide you a regex back. Yeah,
I still think it's
useful. I mean, maybe it's just the archaic soul in me. I still think it's useful to understand how all that shit works, right? But writing the big one liner is not very useful of your time.
Yeah, right. And again, you want to be able to give that ability to a regular person. That it's just like looking at it, making a decision. You want to be able to empower them, not someone that already knows how to use regex. You want to say, hey, discern from this whatever the thing is that I want.
Well, I can tell you that it's not right all the time. It's definitely trash output a lot. I've had to go in and tweak things, and you do have to know how to fix it.
Hey, man, but I'm here to tell you personal experience. Sometimes I've been asked to parse stuff out, and later I realized, oh, man, why did I use this math to determine this thing? This definitely should have been something else. And
some of the one-liners you've sent me over the years are absolutely staggering.
Not even that, but it's just like if I'm building some kind of graph or something for some C-level exec to make a decision on if it's something we continue doing or not. And we make a business decision or an infrastructure decision based on that. And later on, I go, oh, my God,
You've been such like just a hardcore bash guy forever. Like I'll throw Python at something. I move on to more abstracted stuff. Trey's like, nah, dog. We are hanging right here. I'm dropping some Xargs. I am ripping this thing apart in Bash, whether it likes it or not.
I think there's a correlation between the Bash and the Splunk. By the way, now that I'm recognizing.
Oh yeah, for sure. No, that's
the ability to string together arbitrary data and pipelines, right?
Yeah, 100%. That's why I love it so much. I always refer to it as like Legos. It's like I built something and then I built something on top of that, and I built something on top of that. But I do not. Because I also have encountered this even in my current thing. People have built these monstrosities on top of Splunk. I'm like, it's not meant to run these huge pipelines of data and all this other stuff. But yeah, it's like I take a subset, I parse it down, repeatedly do that process. But I mean, you're right. I do like use Bash, but I don't use Bash for things it shouldn't be used for, I don't think.
I have a hot question on this topic, by the
Let's
way.
Let's go.
What do you guys think about pipelining and why it only exists in such a subset of like languages? Like, I mean, like, is pipelining like the best, or is it just niche?
What are you talking? Are you talking about? Because like if you look at like pipelines, or
I mean data pipelining. Like take Bash, right, for example. Something that supports pipelining of basically like running some arbitrary function and then like piping it into the next function, the next function. And Bash is the applications, the individual.
I think it's definitely a thing. There's very few
languages, right? I mean, like, with the exception of like Elixir and a few other like there's very niche languages that do pipelining, but the vast majority of like programming with computers has no concept of pipelining really.
I think it does. They do eventually though. I mean, you're eventually throwing, whether it's a bunch of Lambda functions that then do some sort of ELT type thing, or you've got, I don't know, it seems like eventually stuff still ends up handling
in a pipeline for sure.
outputs and inputs and whatever. And I think like something like Bash was written to be a single pane of glass. I'm so sorry. I've said that so many times today, but single pane of glass, like, we need all of this to happen. Yeah, exactly. So you need everything to happen on one screen. Whereas an actual program, you can abstract that a little bit. You can pull it out. You can stretch it out. You throw in these functions out, and with serverless being so huge, you're breaking it up. But whenever you need to get something done in Bash between multiple programs or whatever, I think pipelining is a thing. But I am not familiar as you may be, or as familiar as you may be, with pipelining within other languages other than Bash.
I really wish. I mean, a lot of languages that are more C traditional, like, really don't do pipelining. And if you see the more modern versions of this, like even like TypeScript or like whatever, like you'll see a lot of people implementing pipelining by like just stringing together functions, like this function returns a big gas thing and then returns the next function,
or like a whole bunch of weird scoping stuff.
No, not so much, but
okay,
my hot take is I really feel like pipelining is a much better user experience for like most people.
100%.
Because of the fact that when you like, you can incrementally step through like, hey, I got this mess. It's a little less of a mess. And you can like see as you're progressing very quickly, like with really fast feedback loops, like what you're getting out of it.
I'm so glad you said that.
It's super iterative. It's very fast.
Yeah.
And it's like, I see it more as scripting language, right? I always think about it like that. I don't consider it like a programming language. I always think of using Bash and stuff as.
Watch out. You're going to get some people pissed.
Yeah. I mean, I disagree with that actually.
I'm joking.
I mean, I do all kinds of stuff in Bash that is not best practice. But like you said, for that, and I always think about like 1970 and Unix, and that was how people interacted with computers. And that was super valuable to just do this thing, take this thing, do this thing with it, and just, again, parse it down, take this part out. And you have stuff like awk, which can do like 90% of text-based parsing or whatever else. But you can also, I mean, there's so much other stuff you can do. As far as feeding that kind of stuff, but I like it because of, like you said, you can start with some lump sum of something and distill it down and check on it every step of the way.
I mean, People, I mean, I might catch some flack from this. I don't know. But honestly, because I have to do things iteratively, this is why my course did so well.
Hang on.
I admit to liking to doing things iteratively. I don't just walk into a one-liner, and I don't pretend like I just walked into a one-liner. There are so many people out there that just drop this just wild stuff. Just like, oh, yeah, no, it just came off the top of my head. It's like, did it? But like, whenever I'm scripting, especially in like Python, doing data stuff, I actually do everything in Jupyter Notebooks. Mm-hmm. I just start there. So many people just hop into Vim or they'll hop into VS Code or whatever. I do everything in Jupyter Notebooks and I find I do a lot better. I solve each problem as it comes. And then, yes, I pipe into the next thing. So I think whenever you mentioned pipelining, I was like, oh, you mean the thing that I do all the time, all day, every day.
And I think that's a good example of it too, because Python doesn't have, like, as a language, doesn't have pipelining, but people just like implement this like idea regardless, like, right, with Jupyter Notebook or like, or if you're not using Jupyter Notebook, you're literally just like putting print statements and like doing the equivalent in a terminal. And I really think there's like something about that 1970s idea like really was lost, I think, in a lot of workflows that I just feel like pipelining is a thing that I wish existed in more C-like languages that don't.
Yeah, it's super natural, I think. I think it's great. Again, I like it. It's just how my brain wants to go through stuff.
I mean, again, I've seen nested functions and stuff that kind of work. It's like, because in Python, you can pass a function to a function and all of this kind of stuff. It gets so nasty, though. It just gets gross by the time people are done with it. They try to get so they think they're pragmatic, but it's just not. It's not at all.
So I think we killed pipelining at this point, so we can probably leave it there. But
good thing we like it. We want more of it. I do it whenever I can.
So we're both like doing consulting in some aspects, Trey and I. I'm going to use this opportunity to kind of like think about or ask some questions around like the consulting space, because I think it's an interesting topic, which is how do we value our time? The consulting is traditionally a hourly thing, right? Like you bill per hour, in some different scaled things, you bill like per month and some like economists, like when you're competing for the dollar amount, right? But in high level, like technical consulting, you're usually billing per hour. So I wonder like what does everyone think about like when you're trying to do consulting for, if you're trying to do consulting, and I think Trey, you're doing way more of this than I am, for multiple businesses, what do you guys value with consulting with the like kind of dollar time trade-off, right? Like, yeah, I guess that's the question.
Well, like this is something I've been thinking about too, is especially here. So I have moved back to the small town where we're from. I still work primarily companies in California, but I have picked up a few local businesses here whose needs have grown over the years, but it is a small area. It is an affluent area of lots of tourism and stuff like that. But there's no real base of technology knowledge here. And it's people like us from in the past that would basically set some stuff up for you and it mostly worked and whatever. But the idea of these businesses having failover internet service providers and all that kind of stuff is just completely foreign. The wireless is strictly just going
to
be
I remember wanting to move to a place where if I asked, hey, have you ever heard of Cisco? If they say the food distribution company and not the networking company, I wanted to keep moving.
I'm also a big proponent about having simple solutions for these people. Like there's no need for someone to have a lot of the crazy stuff that goes
All right, Trey, you're sitting on it. You're building it up. Tell the story. Let's go.
What was I going to say though about it?
About
the cost, right? And the goal I want to have is have a set number of clients charge a monthly retainer of some kind that, and this is what I haven't quite dialed in yet, is do you get X number of billable hours a month? And if you don't use those, how do those roll over? But it's the whole cost thing is so hard to do because people if you do a good job and things never break, people then question why they're paying you money. And at the end of the day, all people really want is someone to just answer the phone immediately when something does go wrong. So if you do things right, they say, well, what am I paying you for? And then you have to maintain that availability that you can answer the phone at any given time and respond to their issues without scaling out the business.
I think hourly is on its way out. I don't know when. I know I've always hated hourly. I always felt guilty. I ran a little computer store. Anytime I'm doing now much larger Terraform projects, all this, it's like, especially with the advent of AI, you're paying me hourly for something I can do in 5 minutes because I spent a decade learning this stuff, obviously.
Not Terraform, yeah, I mean, it's the,
but
the
I spent a decade. I mean, there's the old button story, like, oh, he hit one button and solved a problem, and he charged 10 grand. And it's like, oh, why is it that much? You were only here 5 minutes. He's like, you're paying for my last decade of learning.
Sure.
That kind of thing. And it's like,
it's an interesting take.
It's very true, though. I mean, I think it's Ford is the story about the guy that came and circled where the problem was.
Well, there's that. There's one with there's like one with a ship. There's one with a factory. So they've taken it. Ford probably sounds like something that probably would have kicked that story thing off, but I think I'm more of a results oriented.
He's not as good as BlackBerry.
We've got our first face on the podcast, ladies and gentlemen, and others. We've done it. We've got one face. That's fantastic. But no, like I think I'm more of a results oriented person, and I think that it's going to get to the point, and I don't know how this is going to affect the industry overall, but it's kind of like, honestly, I just want somebody who just wants to be able to run successfully every month, no matter what it takes. And it's going to pay something that makes it worth me getting out of bed in the morning.
Yeah.
But I don't know exactly what that is. I don't know how many customers that is. I don't really know, but I'm here to do what you need within reason. And I need you to take care of your percentage of the number of customers that I have for my livelihood, that type of a thing.
Well, I have some thoughts on this, and maybe take this with a grain of salt, although maybe a few grains of salt, because I did spend some time in the
industry. Watch Trace
world.
Sodium.
Yeah. You've definitely done it.
Yep. I did spend about 5 or 6 years building a fairly successful MSP before I started my own consultancy. And I think it's an interesting topic because at the end of the day, it's always your time that you're trading, right? And practically you really do want to find a way to spend less time when you're dealing with multiple customers. But there's a problem with incentivization for yourself when it comes to trying to bill a flat amount to customers, even if you think very confidently going into it that, you know what, I'm always going to be making, like, a retainer service is probably the meat in the middle. But like, if you are just billing a flat amount, hey, I bill you $1,000 a month or $2,000 a month and call me whenever you need. I think that is a valid strategy as long as you set a limit on how big you want your business to be. If you don't, you're going to very quickly, assuming you're good at what you do, you're going to very quickly approach a situation in which you have to do something suboptimal to your standards, right?
Yeah.
And so as long as you set a limit that, like, hey, I don't want more than 10 clients, or I don't want, then I think that's a perfectly valid strategy. But if you do want to grow past, like, you know, if you want to continue growing a business, I think that there is a disincentivization to billing a flat rate, simply because, like, what will happen is ultimately you will start incentivizing the people you hire unintentionally to do worse of a job at the thing, right?
Well, and plus it scales, right? It scales with the amount of work you do, and not the amount of clients you have.
Yeah. Yep. I see quality. I just see quality as a North Star. If you really put that as a North Star, then not creating an hourly model is problematic.
But the difference is you're talking about hours here that now, thanks to AI for real, and I mean, I'm doing this all the time. I've now taken projects that would take me hours, days, weeks, and taken them down to literally 30 minutes. I mean, The other day I said, I need a sales page. I drew it on a notepad. I took a picture with my phone and I said, hey, do this using Tailwind CSS. Give me the HTML I need for a static page that I'm going to run in GitHub Pages. Kicked it out within 30 seconds. I went in, I tweaked a few things, and then, of course, you do have to know this stuff. Like, you can't
expect
it to be perfect.
How many people can do that process?
Right.
So the thing is, though, is what I'm getting at is that took me 30 seconds or even, we'll just say 2 hours instead of possibly 10. So now,
just charge more because you're a minority of people that can do something complex. It doesn't matter if you're using augmentation of AI or not.
Yeah.
I think that if you can do something that most of the human condition cannot do, if you're not charging enough, that's probably the problem. You're probably just not charging enough.
So what are people going to see first? They're going to see your hourly, or are they going to see how long the project's going to take, and how do you present that to them? Because it's kind of like, I charge $600 an hour, but I'm going to get it done in 3 hours. Like, that makes a lot of sense when you propose the full project.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about, I'm here for you anytime you need me, $600 an hour, nobody's going to see that. Like, that's not
It depends on your client. I'll tell you now, it totally depends on who you're targeting as a client.
That's good.
Okay.
If it's someone that understands, if it's a successful person that understands that the value is the value is the value is the value, not how much work you did, but like how much they're
talking about AI here. So if they're a successful person, what are the odds that they need you?
At this very moment in time, I think you're overestimating the average person's want, drive, ability, capability of doing stuff with AI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Trey knows better than any of us that the average person is, we ain't there yet.
No. I can tell. I have shown it to so many people, like teacher friends, for example. And I'm like, because they have to. I don't know how much you know about teachers, but they have to do all these bullshit lesson plans about. They have to submit them, and here's what we're gonna do for the next 6 weeks. Yep. And you can literally just go to it and be like,
"Right, I am a teacher. Yeah. Thank you."
Yeah, you're right. All right, but write a lesson plan for third graders about the American Revolution. Include one video project and one, and it will just. And every teacher I've shown this to goes, oh my God, this will save me, or this could save me 20 hours a month.
Mm.
Do you think any of them are doing it? I bet not.
Well, they're afraid of it. They don't want anybody to know that they're able to do it. South Park actually did a whole episode on it. South Park had an episode where the students were using ChatGPT to take the tests. Teachers were using ChatGPT to grade the tests. And it got to the point where like both of them were just like, okay, I won't tell you. You don't tell them. It got to everybody be quiet. Let's just all make our lives easier without letting someone who tugs the purse strings know that our job is now easier. Because the second those investors sniff, or whoever the government or whoever it is, or voters sniff that somebody's job is easier, they're going to lose their minds.
Yeah. Well, that goes back to middle management, like we talked about earlier about what part of the cog is turning the machine.
Right.
But
who's the grease and who's the gristle? I just made that up, by the way. Registered trademark.
Write that down. Yeah. I mean, I remember now. So Josh mentioned earlier about augmentation. This is a tool, right? It just... And it bugs me when people want to just outright downplay it, discard it, say, oh, kids aren't learning how to do this or whatever else. It's like, think about when our teachers, we're relevant to this. You're not going to go around with a calculator in your pocket for the rest of your life.
TI-83, bruv.
And it's great that you taught me how to do this math and I can still do it. But the fact that the calculator is going to be more accurate than I am most of the time, faster than I am by order of magnitude.
I remember when I wasn't allowed to carry a TI-89.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, you can only have the TI-83. If you have the 89, that's going to make your life too easy. That's when I was like...
Yeah, you can just store your functions in your calculator. You're supposed to remember these off the top of your head.
Well, I actually... And this is probably a pretty good allegory for this whole thing. I spent so much time in physics class programming my calculator to do all of my physics problems that I never learned the theory. And almost failed. Literally got a D in physics. I had to do like two extra credit projects. You really liked
programming, apparently, and look where you are now. Oh, it was great. I mean, yeah. like the reality is, you're where you ended up for a reason, and I think that's a perfect example of it.
Yep.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, it's like being lazy. I am lazy, but it's like, why would I do all this work when I don't have to? Like, why would I just push a plow in a field when I could put an ox on it?
You got to understand what you're plowing and separate and all of that. And I think that's the thing that a lot of people miss too, though. It's like foundations are so important.
I mean, Josh and I have talked about this a bunch. Like
Josh has talked to both of us about it. That's why we're here, where we are today. Because he is like, hey guys, I just got a CCIE. You know how hard this is?
And well, like, it's just the fundamentals, man. They're just so important of understanding. Yeah. And if you don't, you work with something for a long time, and then you finally do learn some base bit of knowledge of why all this other stuff you worked with forever is, and you go, oh. And there's so much value in understanding the fundamentals, and you still don't understand. I don't know, 1/10 of 1/1000 of.
So do you or Josh, especially you, do you have any tips for somebody that might, and this may not be a problem they think they have, which a lot of us probably don't, but how do we force ourselves with our fully ADHD brains to look at a fundamental that is so easy to solve somewhere else and judge whether it's worth learning or like when should we battle it? How do we battle it? How do we avoid doing it the easy way when we shouldn't?
Yeah, I think that's first off, I think I've changed my mind on this question over the years significantly. 10 years ago, if you asked me this question, I would have easily said fundamentals are the most important thing. And I don't want to discount it. They still are. But I've always been this person that's just like, I refuse to use some magic shit until I understand how it's not magic.
Right.
I've just been that way my whole life. I don't think it's normal and I don't think it's practical, but it's valuable. But I would say that like looking back now and just practically, if you're trying to become the best at something in this world, and I think this extends out of this industry, but like just in general, if you're trying to become the best at something, I genuinely think it's an approach in which you have to get 50 2/3, whatever, like some percentage of the way. There's like a Pareto principle kind of idea here. You have to get some percentage through the way by just like head firsting into the middle. You got to like just get interested, get passionate about the thing. I don't think telling people to learn how processors work at a fundamental level is going to get them interested in building cool apps that help humanity. Yeah. Just, I mean, practically, I refuse, and I had to build the whole thing up from the ground. But if you look at school systems, right, like that is how it's taught. If you look at university programs for CS or even like IT, like it is always taught, generally speaking, from first principles. And it just doesn't seem practical. People have to get passionate first, and then there needs to be some guardrails to then take you back to first principles and build yourself up to mastery. Because the problem is that mastery cannot come without the first principles. However, passion and interest won't come without some exposure to the subject. So it's a weird thing where you have to come in from both angles.
Yeah, I think, I found that, and I'll actually just throw it out there and go to ninth grade, like biology. And they started off with, here's a single cell. Here's all the stuff inside the cell. And I'm kind of like, okay, I'm falling asleep in every lesson. I'm like, oh my God, I have never seen a fucking cell in my entire life.
Apparently there's some inside me. Cool.
Yeah. Why is this important? When I got to the end, I'm like awake for every lesson. I'm like, oh my God, I see the whole process now. This makes so much sense. Look at all these mitochondria and energy and oxygen and Krebs cycle and all this. I'm like, this is so cool. And then I'm like, damn, what were we doing for the past like 6 weeks that got to this point? Why didn't you say, here's why this is important, and give me a why, because I think a lot of us in tech, we need to know the why. We need to know why. Like, we break something, we learn to fix it because it's broken, because it doesn't work. We're trying to get to an end. And like your point with processors, it's kind of like, yeah, I don't really care. That's not something I'm ever going to touch.
No. But and my thing is, like, we're all standing on the shoulders of giants, right?
Love people that saying.
But it's so true. But it's like, the thing is like, they iteratively, if you go back to whenever, it doesn't matter how far you want to go, but more specifically, probably like the 50s, 60s, and 70s, how explosive it got, going from like tubes to transistors and all that stuff. If every one of us had to go through all that, we wouldn't progress. Like, so it like Josh says, jumping in the middle, picking it up, getting enough knowledge to go do more with it. Obviously, I am not doing anything cool like that. But the people that are, they can't start off in the very beginning. Because if you start off in the beginning, you have to do so much before you get to the point where you could have already done something with the amount of knowledge that you could have had without doing super basic fundamentals. And it is irrelevant for most people. It's so abstracted in so many ways. And you don't need to know.
I'll say this. I've been studying a lot of AI stuff, obviously. Like, I've always put off any type of NLP stuff because, like, natural language processing was so bad, just horrible for so long. I'm like, you know what? I just really don't want to learn this. So like, all the courses I took, I would stop at like recommender systems and stuff like that. But I would never really get into the full natural language processing. And of course, all you need is a tension paper comes out and everything changes. All of a sudden, transformers are a thing and GPT is a thing and everything is good, is actually really good. And I found that, so I've started learning. And I've taken a couple courses where they break everything down. And I'm like, okay, I now know why this thing works, you know, why this works. But then again, also I'm like, I could have built 14 apps by now. Like, I could have just strung together a bunch of Python and not worried about that. And I could have done so much more.
Yeah.
And I think trying to find that balance and not bounce between courses so much because you get so, I think they call it, oh, what is it? The beer's kicking in. Trying to think the thing, basically you're going through tutorial hell. That's it. So basically you're going through tutorial hell by the end of it.
There's especially for people like us, there's a real addiction there too. I don't know. Like, I find it, I see it in myself. Like, there's an addiction for me, like studying more than I'm doing. And it's a weird balance that you have to figure out. How much do you want to just be the master of the things that you versus the doer of the things?
I find that it's kind of like whenever you're driving in a dark road and then you just kind of like come to and you're like, shit, have I been driving for like 30 minutes and I don't remember anything? Like, what just happened? But it's basically your brain just getting so used to seeing something that it just shuts everything off. And I find myself doing that in some of these tutorials. I just get to the point where I'm like, so, I'm not absorbing anything. I'm building all these things, but I don't absorb anything at all.
So to answer your original question, which was like, essentially, how do you like know when to hit the fundamental, right? Like, how do you know? I think you only will know if you're truly deeply interested in the thing you're working on. So I'll give you a practical example. We'll hit the AI subject, right? So I can, and I can build a computer on breadboards basically from scratch now. I'd invested my time for whatever dumbass reason in my life to learn how to do that.
Ben Eater has a real soothing voice, man.
It's exactly, you're not wrong. So, right. So I've invested all this time in understanding truly like where we've come from the 40s, 50s, from essentially when we just figured out how like quantum physics works until now. Like, I've invested a lot of time trying to understand that because I really love the history and the fundamentals. I enter this AI ecosystem in the last 10 years and like the huge progress in AI and neural networking in particular. And I'm like, you know what? I want to now learn neural networking from scratch. I just want to really, truly understand it. And so Andre Kripathi, super awesome, excellent dude. I highly recommend everyone check them out.
Hey, no competitors on the show. I'm just kidding. He's not a competitor at all.
He's not at all. He ran. He ran Tesla AI and is now OpenAI. He has excellent information on the subject. I started looking at, like, watching his stuff and like learning, and instantly, instantly I'm like, I have no fucking clue how to do this calculus. Oh, wait, I didn't pay attention at all to calculus.
Yep.
I left school in ninth grade public. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing.
Yep.
And now I'm like, you know what? Khanacademy.com. I'm going to go. I'm going to go learn calculus. I'm 36. I don't know advanced algebra or calculus. However, I've done a lot in my life, right? So, like, I think that it becomes really obvious when something's important and practically important for fundamentals and learning something that actually applies to what you want, what you're interested in.
Oh, I built my Azure version of my AWS Terraform course, just the 2-hour free ones. I built the Azure one with never logging into Azure in my life. I think I built it in a week. You know,
there's always the nuance, but yeah.
There are definitely nuances, like where Microsoft just breaks.
There is, like, every time that you want to, like, add a network interface or something to an instance, like you have to restart the instance. And, like, shutting down an instance takes somewhere between 1 minute and 17 hours. Like, it's like the thing just, it starts spinning, and it's like those wheels on the cars. They don't stop.
The wheels on the bus, they go round and round. Be on the B-roll. All right. So the book I was just talking about, Essential Math for Data Science. This guy's not paid me a dime. But he has helped me out immensely. Like, it jumps through linear algebra, the basics calculus stuff. And all of it is tempered and in the shroud of, like, AI and data science, stuff like that. So it actually gives you, like, instead of just, here's a whole bunch of numbers, put them into this weird sphere or whatever, here's exactly why it's going to be important, and it matters so much to see that end goal. To everything I do, I want to see that end goal. I want to see that path, and it all lines up really well. So,
yeah, I think it's really, and that's why I'm like, here's the thing: you can learn calculus to 80% in a year.
Yeah,
even if you've never touched it. So why not just do it when it's practical? Like, in general, like, I think that that's the right approach for, like, follow your passion, learn the things that are relevant, try to be great at them. Like, don't do them half-ass. Like, truly try to master them.
But I love that you're jumping into the Pareto principle again, too.
Yeah, right?
80-20. So
it's so easy to become 80% mastered of a subject. And if you truly are interested in the thing that it's driving it. I want to truly understand AI. Okay, I need to learn these math things. Now, if I had went into astrophysics, I would have really cared about the math much sooner in life. But I didn't.
Yeah, because you die, you don't get it right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think it's, like, so easy. I think people underestimate how easy it is truly to become very useful in underlying subjects once they need them. And the drive to learn them becomes a lot. You don't have to convince yourself. Like, I need to learn this. It's like, obviously I need to learn this because I really like.
But then
like,
you get that one really guy like walks subject. Around who wants to ask you questions about that 20% while you're at the booth. Yeah. And you're just like, come on, dude, you're never going to buy this product. Go away. Sorry. I was in developer relations, so I got
some stink around. I'm actually doing some of that now. Did I tell you that?
Mm-mm. You didn't.
Yeah, I do some of that now within our own org.
Tell us about it. Okay. So you're a product manager.
No, not at all. What I do a lot of with that is building we're just building it. So the first thing we're doing is building a service registry to give all of our developers internally resources with which to update things in said service registry. So we have runbooks and stuff that we're doing. And the big part about it is automating it and getting information about it from the services themselves to know when was the last time they were updated, when was the last time they were verified, the various checks and everything that are related to every service. And doing, again, we're just now starting it. We're reaching out to the teams now to get them to validate this information. But that's our goal, is to help figure out where everything is, who's working on it, where are all the resources for said services, not just for operations to be able to reach out to them, but for the developers to easily be able to update all their stuff and make sure.
So a product manager.
I'm literally building
what product managers do. They work on resources. They push
the thing that they're doing. I'm not managing anything.
Technical product manager?
You want to throw that's
there? There it is. Yep.
I'm gonna add the technical in front. That'll hit it.
Yep.
I feel dirty.
Well, you could double your salary.
Technical product engineer.
Yeah, there you go.
Ooh,
I'll take that. As long as you put that E word in there.
I saw a funny meme recently about like how like the engineer word is just completely like lost all its meaning.
Oh yeah.
I am a shining example of that. I mean, I think I would say that they've basically taken engineer, which in other aspects, like a bridge, for instance, like I think architect now is more what in tech, an architect is a bridge engineer. Like we've just lowered the bar enough to where
it's embarrassing. I mean,
you put the typical senior, super extra, ultra software engineer next to any mechanical engineer, and they'll start calling themselves developer real quick.
Oh yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Because these guys are actually developing something from the ether.
Partner of engineering.
I think it's the ability to build something from the ether. Like we're plumbers.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, Josh. You might be a little bit more than that, but we're plumbers. We are holy shit, look at all this awesome open source stuff. Let's bolt it all together. This is amazing. Yeah. And I don't care if you built a multi-million dollar SaaS product. We know what it looks like under the hood. We've seen it. It's all plumbing. And that's the great, but I mean, that's the great thing about what we're doing is that we still do stress testing. So if you want to take it to plumbing, for instance, we say like, okay, is this pipe going to handle the Thanksgiving that we just had? Or is this pipe more for something a little less intense?
Washing your hands occasionally. Yeah.
Typical answer to that question, I don't know, let's try it.
Yeah.
Well, that's the awesome thing about tech is we can blow shit up all day long. The worst thing that happens is we lose 37 cents for the 4 seconds of EC2 that we just did.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I love about it is you can just
like roll back our big oops.
Yeah, the stakes are so much higher anywhere else. I would say that, I mean, unless you're in the medical field, you're sending a satellite to space that will actually blow up. Yeah. For the most part, sorry guys, you weren't able to access your like stupid Minecraft for 10 minutes
rocket
or something
scientist
like that.
And brain surgeon.
Yeah.
So let me beg the question, right? Like, why, if that's true, which obviously it is, why is it that this enterprise world is so terrified of doing anything that resembles significant modification or change? Like every door is a door that you can walk in, be like, oh, that was the wrong door. And turn around and walk back through. But yet every company of any like moderate size that's not a startup thinks every door is like slamming behind them with 72 padlocks on the other side.
Raise your hand if you've ever worked at a hosting company, managed hosting. We used to get tickets opened because of seconds. They'd have Pingdom running. They'd be watching their website and literal seconds. I mean, yeah, I definitely rebooted some SQL Server.
How many months has the CTO promised CFO?
Yeah, but we're way beyond SLA here. But my first argument was going to just be three words, service level agreement. But then I realized that people are way worse than that. Yeah. Like, again, they would have Pingdom going and we get tickets open. Like, I saw 2 seconds of downtime. What happened? I'm like, well, we were upgrading MS SQL or we're upgrading something. And so you reboot in sequence and you do things right most of the time. I definitely didn't a couple of times. But and there's still a failover period. There's something that could take a second, 2 seconds, whatever, you will absolutely get a ticket open if it's 2 seconds.
Yeah, it's true, but it's like, I don't know, dude. Like, I think like the greatest, the greatest fast track to mediocrity as a company is to like think every two-way doors, a one-way door.
Like, I wasn't justifying. Like... By the way, I was not justifying the practice. Sure, I was sure, just, sure. Oh, yeah, yeah, you know, just pointing I just see out so many why companies. People don't want it.
Yeah, as a consultant, I just see so many companies, man, that are just like, oh no, we gotta have a quorum about this, and we gotta talk about it for 82 sessions.
Oh, don't
sessions.
Say quorum.
There's so much decision paralysis on something that truly yeah. is not important. It's truly not gonna matter if you make a mistake.
Well, we were talking about bike shedding earlier.
Well, what about yak
shedding? And so the companies just fail to mediocrity by like lack of decision making and lack of like leadership, right? Because they're just scared to like piss off their customers with
SLA. I don't think it's a lack of leadership. Or like, I think it's an overabundance of people in leadership in that middle strata.
Same thing. Yeah. You have a lot of people trying to make decisions. You have no decisions being made.
But again, stuff like that company that I'm working with right now, 2-week turnaround time to get permissions to create a folder. Or create a directory, rather. You know, what in what world is that?
Yeah. I think in American like companies in general, like I've seen...
This isn't an American company, just FYI.
Oh, interesting. But at least in my experience in U.S. companies, I have found that there is a overabundance of executive things happening, right? Like the lopsidedness of companies has been
due to my potential guest list. I'm not allowed to comment here, but I'd love you two to continue the discourse that I may or may not agree with.
Yeah. it's sad and true, and I think
do not reflect that of the host.
I think everyone recognizes this regardless of where they work, right? Like there is a lot of people not doing things, people not making meaningful like work happen.
Well, look at consultancies. It's like everybody's a fucking director because nobody will talk to anyone who isn't a director. And if you have somebody with a director badge, they'll actually pay more to have them in on the meeting, even though they are little more than the engineer. They're probably not even the engineer. The engineers are probably doing way more work. These guys just know how to talk to people.
Something I really like to do is like, and that I've done for clients is I get into, because I'm fairly embedded in these clients, right? Like, I mean, like I'm in day-to-day meetings and decision-making things. And I just like to take, like, just to do a rough dollar estimate on like over a month of all the communications we've had where we've made no meaningful progress towards making decisions, how much. Like just estimate, because I
do shred
know,
that, right? You don't know keep how much that anywhere salary. Somebody can find it.
Yeah. You know how much people generally make in different positions. I mean, it's not hard to find these things on the internet. And so like you can pretty accurately estimate how much money the company is hemorrhaging in any given meeting. And I think it's no one thinks about this, but like if you just like present this to anyone in these companies, they're just like, whoa. And then people think there's like some reason to change things. So I think there's a huge disconnect in people that are in senior leadership of thinking about what actually they're spending not doing anything.
Did you
people
see?
People don't think about the money spent not doing anything.
There was a guy who designed. I think he's a pretty popular UX designer. I can't remember his name, but he did a Google Meet edition that shows the value based on salaries of everybody on the call.
Now that you mentioned that, I'm going to create an overlay for Zoom or something. Right?
Yeah.
This is fucking amazing.
Yeah.
This is
such
a good idea.
Like, yeah, could you imagine? It's just sitting there ticking down, and then like all of a sudden you just look and you see every stakeholder like, I got to jump.
Going up.
Better yet, since no one turns on their camera in Zoom meetings anymore in enterprise, by the way, I don't know if you guys know this, in most companies, no one turns their cameras on.
I don't. I
instead,
do
I'm just going to make my camera this. This is genius. My camera will be simply an incrementing number with a dollar symbol in front of it. This is actually the best thing I could possibly do with my time.
I turn my camera on just to say, oh, thank you, everybody. Bye. I swear to God,
must be
I was
possible,
here the whole
right?
time.
I can just pull like how many people on like from the API. I should be able to pull like how many like people are in the meeting. I should be able to generate this number with reliable ease. Like, even if I estimate like. X percentage is X versus whatever.
At a public company, you could definitely figure it out because you can see just get an average salary. Mm-hmm, I guarantee no matter how much the executives make, which is probably 100 times more than
it's all than somewhere the staff. Between, at least in the Bay Area, it's all somewhere between like 150 to 300 base and then like some bonus structure on top.
So you could actually just go down. You could just say $100,000. You could actually go down to the bottom and it's going to be
literally decision-making information. Even on the bottom end, it's going to be like a, and I remember the first time this was brought up in a meeting I was in probably like 6 or 7 years ago, someone said, because we were getting no progress and a very senior person was like, look, we have a lot of high level, myself not included at the time, I just happened to be in the room. He's like, we have a lot of high level people in this room and we are not getting anywhere with this. This is not a good use of company funds. And when he said it, it wasn't exactly that, but when he said it, I thought, 12 of us, 14 of us in this room. And then you're like, oh, we are dumping thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars into this meeting. That is, and we're talking about trying to save this amount of money. Like, if we hadn't had this meeting, obviously your salary, hopefully you're doing something else with your time. I'm not.
Well, to be devil's advocate, a lot of these guys honestly earn their entire salary with like 1 hour a day. There's like one major decision that they made that was based on their 20 years of experience in tech that actually justifies their existence at $500,000 or whatever. I think as the money rises, the actual like dollar amount per hour that they consume is less and less. I mean, obviously it's extrapolated, but you know, the actual amount of work that they put in is much less, but the work that they finally do put in, the little bit that they do is actually worth a lot more money, allegedly.
Yeah. And I think this just comes full circle back to even in consulting, right? Like, charge more than you think you're worth.
Yeah.
Always. Because realistically, that's going to be true. You're worth a lot more and you should charge a lot more for your time. And you're going to work less, at least per client, as you get more mastery in whatever you're really great at. I'm generally always, because I'm a consultant, I have this like, I guess, privilege, although also like an innate knowledge that I'm generally the most expensive person in most of the meetings for the company that I'm consulting with. And so it's just like, I'm just like super tuned in on like, why are we wasting so much time? Why are you guys paying me like to do this? It's incredible. Like, people will pay me to just listen to someone mumble for 20 minutes about something
to justify and not their existence to their whoever else.
Yeah. So it's just, I don't know.
Well, obviously not your clients, they'd never do that, but other people's clients in that situation definitely do. I do, although none of them are going to listen, I do have 15,000 followers. Just keep that in mind.
I think a lot of people can relate to this in practice. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I was talking to a friend of mine that works for, was here visiting, and he's done really well. Well, he works in like 3D stuff, but did like a lot of government work.
What?
Using too many technical terms, Trey. 3D stuff. I lost
3D to government. No, what I'm saying is 3D to government. That's like a.
No, both. He does 3D stuff like for the government. I guess, I don't know. Like.
Sounds like some GIS type stuff or something.
It's not even that. It's like, but anyway, and
let's just say Skunk Works missile design. Like,
thank you.
Good.
That's where we're
love it.
And anyway, you know, we're talking about just how it's the same everywhere, though. It no matter public, private, it's just you're wasting time, you're wasting effort. Yeah. Shit's held together with spit and string in a lot of places. So you build something, and you're like, this is gonna. We have to replace this. This is not meant to be a permanent solution. Fast forward 5 years, you find the cron job that is restarting some server every single day because it has memory issues or whatever.
Oh my God, I've seen that happen.
No, it's everywhere. It's everywhere.
Every time the process would, the guy literally had the server have a cron job, reboot the server entirely. Yeah. Because the customer like wasn't paying enough for us to actually do a bunch, but they were so annoying that they would call in every day just nonstop because it kept breaking. We're like, dude, it's your code. We cannot do anything about this. And he goes, and he just keeps fighting it. And finally, we're like, all right, look, we've answered the call this many times. Reboot the server on him every single time. So he was rebooting like 2 or 3 times a day. And it's like, whatever, done.
So what you did was you built a watchdog that handled
it. Well, that's what it was. Yeah, it was a watchdog. I like Kron though.
Anyway,
we covered so many things. We covered learning. We covered enterprise. We covered MSPs. We covered so much stuff that I think is going to be useful to damn near anybody. And we drank some pretty good beer.
I did not. So,
oh, you did not. That's correct. So anyway, guys, if you could, for one, thank you for getting me into the industry. I think that's a pretty exciting thing. A lot of people didn't know. The only reason this is here is because of these two. And
really, one, it's just Josh.
Glad you're here, man.
Josh has the biggest coattails of anybody I know.
Trey, you flew me to Boston for a job. So there's that. So anyway, cheers, guys. Everybody do one nice cheers to the camera. All right. And
salute.
I think that's it.